we must again reassemble and take up our lives and move west, eventually settling here where Potomac forks and ways converge from all over the compass, and the fort lies less than a day away. Perhaps I am not meant to govern a great manor like the scalp-stealing fiend Shelby. Perhaps I am ready for this sort of village life, third-time lucky sort of thing. Nor must we ever be moving again. It is Megan, another of Michael's batch. Hair all afire, spirited, no respect at all for traditional authority. She knows how to read, and she is reading him Tox's Pennsylvaniad. It was after Braddock fell that times out here got very difficult indeed. Nima Colin and I put that road in years earlier, chopped damn near every tree. We were the original Mason and Dixon. We cut our visto too narrow for poor Braddock, but who was expecting an army? We went by compass. I felt that cold magic in the needle, sirs, something very powerful from far beyond this forest, whose bark had never felt the bit's assault, as Tox puts it so well. As for Nima Colin, I believe that he lived in a world where magic is in daily operation, and the magnetic compass surely is small turnips. What will the Mohawks that are to join us think of our instruments, then? Dixon wonders. They'll be curious. Good idea to satisfy them on all questions, wagering that they may not ask the fatal one, why are you doing this? If that happens, your only hope is not to react. It is the first step into the quagmire. If you be fortunate enough to emerge, 'twill not be with your previous optimism intact. Why am I doing this? Mason inquires aloud of no one in particular. Dammy, that is an intriguing question. I mean, I suppose I could say it's for the money, or to advance our knowledge of... regard thyself, thou reacting, says Dixon. What friend Cresap here said not to do, thou art doing it. Why not, as the Stoic ever says? You might yourself advert to it profitably. What crime am I charged with now? Ever for thou? How convenient. Wait, wait. You're saying I don't take blame when I should, that I'm ever pushing it off onto you? Wasn't I that said it? Dixon's eyebrows headed skyward, nostrils aflare, with some last twinkling of geniality. I take the blame when it's my fault, cries Mason, but it's never my fault. And that's not my fault either. Or, to put it another way, I tell the pit pony, too, why don't they? Children, children, admonishes the patriarch, let us be civil here. Am I not a justice of the peace, after all? Now, which is the husband? This is greeted by rude mirth, including, presently, Dixon's, though not even a chuckle from Mason, who can only, at best, stop glowering. This is taken as high hilarity, and the corn continues to pass round, which Mason is obliged to drink. The unglazed rim, unwipeably wet from the loose-lipped embraces of mouths that may recently have been anywhere, not excluding, from the look of the company, live elements of the animal kingdom. Dixon, being a grain person, is having a generally cheerier drinking life than Mason, as the further west they go, the more distilled grains and the fewer wines are to be found. Until at last, even to mention wine aloud is to be taken for a French spy. At Cumberland, as yet, Mason hasn't dared ask, though if it's to be found anywhere, 'twill be at the market, every day, Sundays as well, lying spread up to the gray stone revetments, beneath the black guns, the shadows of the bastions, the lookouts curiously astare, Indians from the far interior, with not only furs to trade, but medicinal herbs too, and small gold artifacts. Drinking cups, bangles, charms from fabled lands to south and west. Upland Virginians come with shoes by the wagon load, Philadelphia mantua makers with stitch-by-stitch copies of the modes of London and Paris, booksellers from the brick ravines of Frederick with the latest confessions from Covent Garden, piemen and milkmaids and women of the night, life stories spread upon blankets, chuck-farthing games in the ditch, everywhere sounds of metal, a clang in the forges, squeaking rhythmically in the mud street. Bells in the church, iron nails poured in jingling heaps, specie in and out of purses. The skies are biblically lit, bright yellow and slate blue and purple, and the munitions wagons, whose horses in a former life were humans who trafficked in land, pass going and coming, laden and empty, darkly gleaming in long streaks down their sides, from what stormlight the conditions of the sky will allow. Dogs run free, feel hungry and accordingly impatient, often get together in packs and hunt. Has no one heard of the black dog in these parts then? Wonders Dixon. The South Mountain dog? He'd best step cautious round my snake. Here's half a crown. Says your snake won't last a minute with my Ralph. Done, you bugger. No one, of course, is asking the dogs who would prefer sleep or a good meal. But these packs are running according to different plans. Life here is not quite so indulgent or safe as back east in the brick towns. There, you forage for food already dead. Here, they encourage you to answer to the wolf's commandments, to kill what you eat and eat what you kill, and somehow to try to resist the jackal within, ever crying for carrion. Not all do. At the fort, you may always find commissary garbage, tidbits from officers who want favors, more temptation than a dog ought to resist. Every dog upon the post, at one time and another, has succumbed. This helps enhance the harmony within the pack, for they are sharing a sin. Snake, who has a reputation as a ratter, is less fond of eating his prey than of killing them. Chasing rats is a good pastime, combining speed and the art of getting a step ahead, as well as perfecting solitary fighting skills. For he cannot depend on the pack being there every time he might need it so, and he figures that if he can slay a rat, he can slay a squirrel with no trouble, up a tree, down a hole, the idea being never to let it get there, to interdict. When Mason approaches him in a friendly way, he decides to trust him rather than take the trouble to bare his teeth for nothing. All about, the humans and their children come and go, eating upon the run, flirting, having disputes about money. The scents of food, small fires, and other dogs are everywhere. Hello, Snake. The man down on his haunches, keeping a fair distance, no wish to intrude. Snake raises his head inquiringly. I'm assuming that Norfolk Terriers, like other breeds, maintain a web of communications among them. And I was but curious after the whereabouts these days of the learned English dog, or as I believe he is also known, Fang. Snake ponders. His policy with strangers, indeed with his very owner all these years, being never to reveal his own power of speech, for he's known others, including the credulous Fang, in fact, who've trusted humans with the secret, only to find themselves that very evening in some assembly room full of smoke and noise, and no promise of dinner till after they've performed. Not for Snake, thank you all the same. Something must be getting through by way of his eyebrows, however, for the man is now smiling, lopsidedly, trying to seem cognizant. You are said to be fond of rats. Our expedition chef, Monsieur Allegre, is preparing, as we speak, his world-famous queue de rats au haricot, if that be any inducement. More like an emetic, Snake thinks, but does not utter. Fond of rats? Who is this idiot, anyway? All I'd require would be a nod after I say, has he gone north? South? You haven't nodded. East? Then, only west remaining, I'll take that as a nod, shall I? Mason, Dixon looming, vaporous of ale, the bright glacis behind him, are thou quite comfortable with the logic of that? The man grumbles to his feet. Snake, snake, snake! If there remained a farthing candle between us and Monongahela, yet unsnuffed, be certain ensign enthusiasm here would find and snuff it. Yes, once again, Dixon, you have saved me from my own poor small hopes. How relentless. Thanks ever so much. Happen thy impetuosity be no candle, rather an ill-considered fire. From watching humans out here over the course of several winters, Snake recognizes between these two a marked degree of acidity. They walk away now, gesturing and shouting at each other. Snake puts his head back upon his paws and sighs through his nose. Old Fang. Who, after all, could claim to know Fang's true story? Some saying he did it to himself, others blaming the humans who profited from his strange abilities. Is not Snake's way to inform on another dog, and withal, who knows what that human was up to, wanting to see him after so much time? The surveyors face each other before a hazy ground of blue distance and ascension, the blue silences that await them. I know something is out there that may not happen till we arrive. I am a northern Brit, a semi-Scot, a gnome's intimate. We never err in these things. Gone too far as usual. When will he learn? Never. I know what thou wish to happen, what thy hope to find. 'Twould be the only thing that could have brought thee to America. And you say you think you can feel? Don't know what it is. Heard of Buffalo as easily as light from elsewhere. Something of about that impact. You promise you're not just trying to be encouraging in that cheery way you put on and off like a wig. I wouldn't joke about that, not with thee, with young Hickman, perhaps, or Tom Hines. Who are, what, 12, 10? They think they'll live forever. Of course you can all joke about it. The gents locate an ale barrel in the shade. A Virginia boy, 7 or 8, or thereabouts, comes running up to quiz with them. I can show you something no one has ever seen, nor will anyone ever see again. Mason squints in thought. There's no such thing. Aha! The lad produces an unopened goober pea shell, exhibiting it to both astronomers before cracking it open to reveal 2 red peanuts within. Something no one has seen, popping them in his mouth and eating them. And no one will see again. The gents, astonished, for a moment look like a matched pair of goobers themselves. Chapter 67. Within the fortnight, they are joined by a delegation of Indians sent by Sir William Johnson, most of them Mohawk fighters, who will remain with the party till the end of October, when, reaching a certain warrior path, they will inform the astronomers that their own commissions from the 6 nations allow them to go no further, with its implied corollary that this path is as far west as the party, the Visto, and the line may proceed. This will not come as an unforeseen blow, for Hugh Crawford, accompanying the Indians, informs the surveyors of it first thing. Sort of like death. You know it's out there ahead, though not when, so you'll ever be hoping for one more day at least. We'll be crossing Indian trails with some regularity. These don't trouble the Mohawks in particular. But ahead of us now, there's a track, running athwart the Visto, north and south, known as the Great Warrior Path. This is not merely an important road for them, but indeed one of the major highways of all inland America. So must it also stand as a boundary line, for when we come to it, we shall not be allowed to cross it and go on. It'll take us a quarter of an hour. We'll clean up every trace of our passage. What are they worried about? The running surface? Their deerskin shoes? We'll resurface it for them. We'll give them moccasin vouchers. Mr. Mason, they treat this trail as they would a river. They settle both sides of it so as to have it secure. They need the unimpeded flow. Cutting it with your Visto would be like putting an earthen dam across a river. And how far from Ohio? With a slight break upon the word. Some 30, 40 miles, Crawford, as kindly as he can, having himself a history of disappointments out here again and again. Yet the path is over Monongahela, silently adding, Saco Stumbre, as he's heard the Western Spanish say, one gets used to it. His is a face, however, difficult for Mason, or for many, to read much sentiment in, so written upon is it by so many years of hard sunrises, elements outside and in, left to rage as they might. It's a fine road. I've had to use it now and then. If the wind and moon are right, you can fly along. Sometimes they chased me. Sometimes it was me after them. We've chased these damned mountains through and through, canoeing for our lives down these mean little rivers. Made some respectable fortunes, lost them in the space of a rifle shot, as many of us taken or destroyed over the years as got back safe. Ups and downs, steeper than the Alleghenies, gents. I've been captured, I've escaped. We've been friends and enemies. They owe me years out of my life, parts of me not working so good. You'd have to ask them what they think I owe back. But I know 'em, not in any deep or magical way, rather as you may know those that you've shared matters of life and death with. And although on paper it may look like only a few short steps from the warpath to the River Ohio, I beg you both be most careful, for distance is not the same here, nor is time. At least they told us beforehand, Dixon supposes. Watching an Indian slip back into the forest is like seeing a bird take wing. Each moves vertiginously into an element Mason, all dead weight, cannot enter. The first time he saw it, it made him dizzy. The spot in the brush where the indent had vanished vibrated as an eddying of no color at all. Contrarywise, watching an indent emerge is to see a meaningless darkness eddy at length into a face, and a face, moreover, that Mason remembers. He grows apprehensive and soon kickish. I respect them and their unhappy history, but they put me in a state of anxiety unnatural, he complains to the Reverend, out of all measure, unto the apparition of phantoms. How's that? I see and even touch things that cannot possibly be there. Yet there they are. Can you give me examples? There may lie a problem, for I am closely sworn not to. Makes advising you difficult, of course. Yes, and some of them are pips, too. Shame, really. Whilst you so amiably quiz with me, says the Reverend, Mr. Dixon seems quite content in their company. Who, young jollification? Drinks with priests, roysters with pygmies? Aye, I've seen that. What cares has he, as long as the tobacco and spirits hold out? And withal, throughout, from first sip to empty bottle, he is troubled by no least inkling of sin, nor question of fear. He is far too innocent for any of that. No, 'tis I who am anxious before the advent of these visitors, how strange, who belong so without separation to this country, cryptic and perilous, passing, though never close, as shadowy and serene as deities of forest or river. So, cries Mason, turning desperately to the visitors, you're Indians. Mason, that may not be quite. As Hugh Crawford is translating, they hope that's what he's doing, the Mohawk chiefs, Hendricks, Daniel, and Peter, the Onondaga chiefs, Tonadoros, Sachinhondix, and Tondego, the warriors, Nicholas, Thomas, Abraham, Hononheriyowa, John, Sawatis, Jemmy, and John Sturgeon, the women, Sosina and Hannah, all are examining Mason and Dixon and the instruments. Having earlier observed the sector arriving in its pillowed wagon, mindfully borne by the 5 shilling hands, impressive in its assembled size. Learning that 'tis used only late at night, some presently are there each time to watch as the astronomers lie beneath the snout, the brass elongating into the heavens, the great curved blade, the sweeps of stars converging at the eye, so easily harmed even at play, hostage like this beneath the instrument poised upon it. The first time they see the sector brought into the meridian, the Indians explain that for as long as anyone can remember, the Iroquois nations as well have observed meridian lines as boundaries to separate them one from another. Not rivers nor crest lines? Captain Zhang is amazed. What did the Jesuits think of that? We learned it of them. One story, Hendricks adds, others believe 'twas not the Jesuits, but powerful strangers, much earlier. Who? The same, declares Zhang, whose interests we have continued to run across evidence of, who, for the term of their absence, are represented by Jesuits, encyclopedists, and the Royal Society, who see to these particular routings of Sha upon the surface of the planet by way of segments of great or lesser circles. Shall we resign our commissions? Is that what you're saying? Then somebody else does the same thing, the geomancer shrugs. Then thou'll go to work for them, for thy commission is to stop it, not so? All thou about Zarpazo was snuff. Ethel would hang after all, his dog first gives out that he is mad. Excuse me, Mason said. I think that's he who would hang his dog first gives out that he is mad. Why would anyone hang his dog? No, 'tis he who wishes to hang, sends his dog to run round acting peculiar, perhaps wearing signs about its neck, or strangely costumed, so that whenever its owner does hang, people can say, you see, 'twas madness, for the dog gave out he was mad. Yes, that would all no doubt be true, if that were how it goes, but it's not how it goes at all. It goes, and so on, records the Reverend. This actually very interesting discussion extended till well past midnight that night. If I did lose full consciousness now and then, 'twas less from their issueless bickering than from the demands of the day, as part of the tribute we must pay merely to inhabit it. That night I dreamed, I pray 'twas dream, that I flew some 50 to 100 feet above the surface down the Visto straight west. First dream I ever had that smelled of anything. Cut wood, sap, wood smoke, cook tent cooking, horses and stock. I could see below the glow of the coal we cut from outcrops, so shining black they must be the outer walls of hell. almost like writing upon the long unscrolling of the land. Useful about the wagoner's forge, a curiosity beneath Mr. McLean's oven, and to Mr. Dixon, who knows his way around a bit of coal, a quotidian delight. His brother George learned years ago how to make coal yield a vapor that burns with a blue flame, and with a bit of ingenuity with kettles and reeds and clay to seal the joints, why, it may even be done in the midst of this wilderness, as Mr. Dixon promptly demonstrated. And that is how I verify 'tis no dream, but a form of transport, that unearthly blue glow in the otherwise lightless desert night. The Indians come to look, but they never comment. They have seen it before, and they have never seen it before. The line makes itself felt. Through some energy unknown, ever are we haunted by that edge so precise, so near. In the dark, one never knows. Of course, I am seeking the warrior path, imagining myself an heroic scout. We all feel it looming, even when we're awake, out there ahead someplace, the way you come to feel a river or creek ahead, before anything else, sound, sky, vegetation, may have announced it. Perhaps 'tis the very deep, sub-audible hum of its traffic that we feel with an equally undiscovered part of the sensorium. Does it lie but over the next ridge, the one after that? We have mileage estimates from rangers and runners, yet for as long as its distance from the postmarked west remains unmeasured, nor is yet recorded as fact, may it remain a shimmer among the few final pages of its life as fiction. Were the Visto to have crossed the warrior path and simply proceeded west, then upon that cross-cut and beaten into the wilderness would have sprung into being not only the metaphysical encounter of ancient savagery with modern science, but withal a civic entity, four corners each with its own distinguishable aims. Sure as Polaris, the first structure to go up would be a tavern, the second another tavern. Setting up businesses upon the approaches, for miles along each great conduit, there would presently arrive wagonsmiths, stock auctioneers, gunmakers, feed and seed merchants, women who dance in uncommon attire, lanterns that burn all night, pavements of strange metalling brought from afar, along with all the other heavy cargo that now streams in both directions, the fleets of Conestoga wagons, ceaseless as the fabled herds of buffalo further west. Sunlit canopies a billow like choir-sung promises of flight, their unsparred wheels rumbling into the soft, dairy nightfalls of shadows without edges, though black as city soot. Festive lanterns, by contrast, shine through the glass of the swifter passenger conveyances that go streaking by above the fields, one after another, at all hours of the day and night. Aloft, these carry their wheels with them, barely scuffed by roadway, to be attached whenever needed. Singing and gaiety may be heard passing through the airy gulfs above. Newcomers to the lay-born life are advised not to look up, lest, seized by its proper vertigo, they fall into the sky. For it has happened more than once. Drovers and army officers swear to it, as if gravity along the Visto is become locally less important than rapture. One night, yet east of Laurel Hill, Mason asks, "Where is your spirit village?" The Indians all gesture straight out the line, west. "God dwells there, at the horizon?" They nod. "And where is yours?" asks Hendricks. Mason rather uncertainly indicates up. Dixon cocks a merry eye. "What's this, only at the zenith? Not something a little more, all-encompassing?" waving an arm to illustrate. Surveyors and Indians have been out looking at the stars, discussing the possibility of life upon other worlds, whether and how much our awareness of such life might figure in our awareness of God, God then vis-a-vis gods, and other topics of such interest to my profession that I felt obliged to listen in. "What puzzles us about stargazing," says Daniel, "is that you are ever attending them, and never they you." "Have they attended you?" Mason, unprepared to believe it. "Many times, never all at once, usually but one at a time. Yet they do come to us." "Sounds like fishing," supposes Dixon. "The Indians like that. Sky fishing," says Hananariowa. "Shouldn't someone explain about the bait?" young Jemmy whispers, loud enough to receive a number of looks from his party, ranging from amused to annoyed. "Hey," Dixon encourages him, "tell me, and I'll give thee the secrets of my amazing bread lure, famous the length of the weir and beyond for bringing them in." You spoke of it first, Hendricks reminds the lad. Is the safety of your soul, says Jemmy. He has lately been out upon his trial of passage from child to adult, having found his protector, a bear who walked toward him on her back feet with her arm extended in the precise Six Nations gesture for peace. Now, however perilous the trails may grow, she can be summoned in an instant. Yet I had to risk all. To bring her in, I had to fasten all that I was upon a line I could not break, and wait, sleepless, starving not only with my body, but with... Arsonical interpolation, shouts Uncle Lomax. My spirit. What, Lomax, may not a Mohawk youth possess a needful spirit? Thank thee, Jemmy, at any rate, Dixon now replied. My bread lure is a bit safer than thou, and here's how it's done. Whereupon they withdrew out of my hearing, so that regretfully I quite missed the information. Oh, cuz, what stuff? I have witnessed this bait in action, madam. I saw Dixon bring in fish not even native to the region, let alone the creek. Fish never seen before in those parts. Salmon trout out of farm ponds you'd think couldn't hide a frog. Chesapeake rockfish well over the Allegheny Ridge. The rarely encountered inland tuna, all with that miraculous compound of his. I have personally taken with it sea bass of weight unknown, but that it required two of us to carry one back to the cook tent, with all trout innumerable, even as close by other anglers drowsed at their rods, hoping it best to intercept some unwary perch. Believe me, if I knew the secrets, I should be producing this receipt from a mill by the hogshead and wallowing in revenue. See that group of stars over there? Daniel points to the Big Dipper. We call it the Great Bear, Mason instructs them. So do we, betraying no surprise. And that bent line of stars by it? The bear's tail. The Indians are merry for some moments. Bears in your country have long tails. That is a very long-tailed bear. Are you sure it's not something else? Those stars you call a tail are the hunters who come after the bear. Where are your hunters? Mason indicates Bootes and the hunting dogs, so styled officially, though in practice we call them the hounds. Mason remembers from his youth a market night, all of them in the bed of the wagon, lumbering home late from Stroud. The sun went down and the stars came out, and Charlie went on about the stars. The schoolmaster calls it Ursa Major, the bigger of the two bears, and that's the little one there. My father called it the Baker's Peel, his father told him. Mine always said Charles's Wain, recalled his mother. Charles was the name of a great king over in France. Hurrah, cried Hester. Here we all are, riding in Charles's Wain. And it was one of the few times he could remember his father laughing, too. Mason looked up at his parents' faces, turned aside under a great seeded sky without a moon, under the unthinkable leagues of their isolation. He would remember them all together like that, as if they'd lived at the edge of some great lighted sky structure, with numberless lanterns hung and shadows falling everywhere, and pathways in, upon which once having ventured, he might account his life penetrated, and the rest of it claimed. He thought he knew every step he had taken between then and today, yet can still not see, though the dotting of every last I in it be known, how he has come to the present moment, alone in a wilderness surrounded by men who may desire him dead, his kindred the whole ocean away, with Dixon his only sure ally. Are we in danger? He sees little point in not asking. Oh, sure, and ask the Mohawk, cries Daniel. If the topic be danger, he knows all. And let's not omit violence, terror, weaponry. Am I leaving anything out? Sorry, I'm sorry, Mason mumbles. Daniel sniffs and shakes his head. Scalp but one white man, everyone starts assuming things. Yes, of course you are in danger. Your heart beats. You live here, gesturing all around. Danger in every moment. May I ask about vegetables, at least? Esculents notable for their size? That won't offend anyone. I am not one of your vegetable-wise Mohawks. You need to talk with Nicholas. All the way back to the tents, Mason catches Daniel casting him glances, no longer of curiosity, but of judgment rendered. In camp, they find Nicholas conducting a discussion upon the very topic. He is amiable in responding to Mason's inquiries, even when these carry an anxious undersurge. Or far to the north and west, Hugh Crawford translates, lies a valley, not big, not small, a place of magic. Smoke comes out of the mountains, the earth rumbles, springs of fire run everywhere. Volcanical activity, Mason helpfully. In this valley, plants, vegetables grow big, very big. Big corn. Each kernel's more than a man can lift. Big turnip. Six-man crew to dig out but one. Big squash. Big enough for many families to eat their way into and then live inside all the winter. Very big, big hemp plant. The Mohawk is upon his feet, pretending to look in astonishment at something nearly straight overhead. Dixon, as if suddenly waking, inquires, "Well, how big's the, Nicholas?" Late in the season, to climb to the top of a female plant is a journey of many days, Redcoat. They beam mischievously at one another, a look that Mason, in his excitement, does not pick up, babbling, "Because of the volcanic soil, obviously. A marvel. Crawford, ask him about carrots." "Big," the Indian replies directly, smiling and nodding. Mason notices that everyone is nodding. "Hemp plant," Dixon reminds Nicholas. Many people, he explains, even from far away, make the journey and ascent. In earlier times, they climbed to a limb wide enough not to roll off of and camped there overnight. But 'twas a fixed season and a growing demand. Soon the great limbs grew crowded. Some travelers were not careful with their campfires, starting larger fires soon put out, though not before producing lots of smoke, big smoke. Depending upon the winds, often climbers were delayed for days. The first longhouses began to appear under the sturdier branches, each season's pilgrims sleeping in them overnight, then traveling on upward, others remaining to wait for them, smoking meanwhile resin broken from some bud nearby and wrapped in a piece of leaf, the whole being twisted into a great cigar. Soon sheds were added to the limb-side inns, serving as depots for the jobbers who buy direct from the bud. Bands of renegados arrived to attack and rob the enterprisers, who accordingly must band together in armed convoy. Yet desperate men will assault even these vertical caravans. 'Tis a lively time out there upon the stalks. This valley, how far away is it? Dixon, with a dark breathlessness, as if upon the right answer, he will immediately rush off into the night. Gesturing toward gentle Alioth, "Too far. You would not go, Redcoat." "Perhaps I might." Nicholas is laughing now. "Perhaps no need to." Patiently he tells the story of the giant hemp plant again, making his voice loud on words such as jobber and resin. Mason gets a glimmer. He's trying to sell us something. Frantic now, the Mohawk is making wild smoking gestures, puffing imaginary smoke right in their faces. "Smoke," says Dixon. "Thee mean smoke? Oh, sublime succedaneum." He thinks he's back at the Cape, Mason's eyes cast skyward, where he grew so abstracted that I had to keep reminding him of the date of the transit, aye, even upon the day itself. How he attended the clock and telescope as closely as he did remains a mystery. "Daga hath many mysteries," Dixon replies. "One being that talking about things, while not exactly causing them to happen, does cause something, which is almost the same, though not quite, unless it is possible to smoke a potato. That is, the first of the giant vegetables does not seem all that large, remarkable at some fair in the country, perhaps, but hardly the faith-challenging specimens that lie yet a ridgeline or two away, further west, where they are soon to be found ever larger, abandoning the incremental, bringing into question the very creation." "I don't see it," Dixon apologetic. "There'll always be a few very large specimens of anything I like. This is acre upon acre, and cannot be God's work." West of Cheat, they discover Indian corn growing higher than a weathercock upon a barn. What they take for a natural hill proves but the pedestal for a gigantic squash vine thicker than an ancient tree trunk, whose flowers they can jump into in the mornings and bathe in, sometimes never touching the bottom. Single tomatoes tower high as churches and shiny enough to see yourself in, warped spherical, red as blood, with the whole great sweep of forest and river and vista curving away behind. And the smell, apothecarial, estral, musk heavy. One must bring along a bladder filled with fresh air and now and then inhale from it if one does not wish to swoon clean away in these gardens titanic. Did ye hear someone going fee-fi-fo-fum? Mason frowns. And yet, might these not be the products of human art? Folly. No philosopher, however ingenious, not Mr. Franklin himself. Look at it, for heaven's sake. You can't see the top, like some damned palm oasis here. My guess is it's the top of a carrot, replies Dixon, though of some size, of course. Yet let us further imagine that where there is a vegetable patch, there must be someone, something, tending it. I suggest we... Too late. You're welcome, sirs, though you're not supposed to be here. Is a group of farmers, despite whose middling age and height, proximity to any of the plants in their care gives the look of serious elves. Rifles back at the barn, so I can't kill ye. Yet you're Brits by the look of ye, so we cannot trust yous neither. Why keep it a secret? Why not rather notify the Pennsylvania Gazette? We but look after these, for others who are absent, pending their return, in the meantime being allowed the free use of all we may grow. They are invited to follow. The seeds are stored in sheds especially built for them, each able to shelter one, at most two, for the winter. In the spring, planting but a few of them is a communal task, easily comparable to a barn raising. Last year's potato, lying in the giant root cellar dug beneath the nearer pasture, is assaulted by adze and hatchet and taken by hand carts to the kitchen to be boiled, baked, or fried in as many ways as there are wives on hand with personal receipts. Nothing, cries the head gardener. Wait till you see the beet. The beet is of a circumference requiring more than one entryway. All who pass much time going in and out, whether for reasons of residence or investigation or indeed nutrition, eventually acquire a deep red indigo stain that nothing can wash away. Like Geordie Pittman, though more colorful, it seems to Dixon, and which is less reasonable all round, ever to place thy life's wagers upon a large though finite vegetable on the earth or a like-sized vein of coal beneath it? The beet, at least, ye can see. Yet does it live, declares their guide. You don't mean, Mason markedly less eager to have a look inside now. We are as garden pests to it. It suffers us, we being unworthy of its full attention. It understands what we say? Mason's eyes fallen into an alternating squint, with one right-left-right cycle taking about a second. There are schools of thought as to that. Another lively question is, does it remember the days when we were bigger than beets? Yes, by about the same proportion, do you notice, that beets are now bigger than us? Now that the tables are turned, do they harbor grudges? Do they have a concept of revenge, perhaps for insults we never intended? Chapter 68. By this time, they're making a mile or two per day. On the 7th of August, they cross Braddock's Road at 189 miles and 69 chains. 32 chains further on, they cross the road a second time. The next day, a mile and 35 chains beyond that, they cross it a third time. I'm not content with this, Dixon, not at all. Three agents for Philadelphia land speculating interests are said to be out here this summer scouting real estate: Harris, Wallace, and Friggs. The Metropolitan Cabal back there, 'tis said, goes upon the hope of the next purchase of the Indians of as much trans-Alleghanian land as possible. The settlers, having been served eviction notices last year by Captain Mackey and the Highland 42nd, and withal surveying itself about to be proclaimed a crime, £50 fine and 3 months in jail, these gentlemen suppose they may take over the rights out here for virtually nothing. 3 months for surveying, Mason marvels. And if someone's been doing it all his life? And think of the money. Is that £50 per act of surveying? Per diem, perhaps. Thank ye, friend Mason. Before crossing the big Yochiogeni in the evening after mass, the surveyors gather all who followed the party undaunted this far. Now, like Prospero, must I conjure you all away, for from here to the warpath we'll have no time for gentle recreations, but must stand watch and watch for as far west as we may. Well, no musicians. The Indians love our music. The Indians will need their ears for other tasks. We must go back to that fort then. We'll wait for them at Cumberland. A long way, sister. So far, we've enjoyed an escort of Mohawk fighters, best in the land. Who will be protecting us on the way back? Might get lucky and hook up with a band of axemen headed home. They'll be long gone, absorbed like hailstones into the earth. Well, I'm not languishing by the banks of the Potomac. I'm for some place with lamps outdoors and purses full of idle specie. Anybody for Williamsburg? They arrange to keep the sector at the house of Mr. Spears, where Braddock's Road meets the bank of the Ochio, and go in search of the ferryman, Mr. Ice. They expect a ferryman to be silent, announces he, his eyes aglimmer, taking his coat and draping it over his head so as to hood his face. Well, welcome aboard. Smoking lamps lit on this craft. On shore, his brother-in-law is letting out the line, allowing them to be taken by the stream, as his nephew, upon the further side, waits to begin hauling them in. Exactly at the middle of the river, for a moment, no one can see either father or son. To appearance, the passengers stand upon a raft in a boundless body of water. Now, here is what they did to me and mine. And the last Ice proceeds to tell every detail of the massacre that took his family in the dread days of Braddock's defeat. Time, whilst he speaks, is abolished. The mist from the river halts in its ascent. The frogs pause between croaks, and the peepers in mid-peep. The great black cobbles of the riverbed stir and knock no longer. The dead are being summoned. The ferryman's grief is immune to time, as if in exchange for a sacrifice of earthly freedom to the flow of this particular stream. You think this is some kind of penance? Hey, I enjoy this. Such looks on passengers' faces when they hear how the flesh and bones of those I loved were insulted. They are used to tales of Frederick's ranked automata executing perfect maneuvers upon the unending German plain. Down here in the American woods, that same war proceeded silently, in persistent shade, one swift animal death at a time. No treaty can end it, and when all are dead, ghosts will go on contending. 'Twas the perfect war. No mercy, no restraint, pure joy in killing. It cannot be let go so easily. The Occoganey, coved and willowed and sycamored, has no fish in it that Mason has been able to learn of. Yeah, you'll hear that, says Ice, yet everyone up and down this river knows of the great school of ghost fish that inhabit it. Pale green, seldom seen, two sets of fins each side and a tail like a dragon's. They travel unmolested where they will, secure in the belief that no angler in his right mind would dare attempt to catch any of them. And that, sir, could be where you come in. Dixon is trying to nudge Mason alert, but owing to the darkness, not always connecting. Mason is already simpering like a milkmaid. Ooh, sir, I am but a country coarse fisher after the odd chub or roach. Whatever the mills haven't killed or chased off, actually, is usually what I settle for. And goodness, why, this fish of yours sounds far too much for my light rod skills, being so very, as you might say, big. Mason, Dixon, not often a mutterer, mutters. Up to 5, some say 6 foot long, Ice avows, big as a man or woman, pale as a floating corpse. Yet these do live, though few have dared, some of us out here have taken ghosters. I could show you more than one, stuffed and mounted, no question of eating them, of course. Indeed, no question of trying to hang one over the hearth, given the wives who object to looking at them for long, or at all. The Ochio, as it comes down off the mountains of Virginia, descends very rapidly, very dangerously. You might not want or even be able to wade in it. Some think it's the fall, the very speed of the flow, that creates those ghosters. No one knows. Their entire lives are engulfed unceasingly in change. They never come to rest. They never know an instant of tranquility. One wonders what must their idea of death be. Ice's feigned smile, nearly unendurable. How are they going to deal with eternal rest? Unless this world be already their purgatory, and they no longer classifiable as living fish. And what of those who seek them? Ghosters are accorded a respect comparable to that shown the dead. If we get out upon this river tonight, says Mr. Ice, perhaps we'll see a few. They like it just after the rain. In the sunlight, they show up against the black rocks of the riverbed. In the dark, they glow some. For one another, they do. Us, they pay no mind. In a way, that could prove an advantage to an angler bold enough. Pray you, Mason's hands upon his bosom. Mr. Ice, abruptly turning to Dixon, forgive me, sir, if I stare. Yours is the first red coat to be seen in these parts since Braddock's great tragedy. The only ones out here with opportunity to wear one being the Indians who from the corpses of English soldiers took them. Even to these savages, even intoxicated, 'tis too much shame ever to put a red coat on. Yet I find it a means, when in the forest, of not being innocently mistaken for an elk. Nor should anyone mistake me for a tearful fool, advises Emmanuel Ice, merely upon observing how I must battle against a daily sadness. The graves of my family are in back of the cabin, up that meadow, near the line of cedars. I visit every day. Yet grief too solitary breeds madness. At my work I meet a good many of the public who travel in these parts, who will sometimes, like you, let me bend their ears with my particular woes. It keeps away the madness, eh? You think it's over out here, Redcoat? It's not over. The fall of Quebec was not the end, nor Bouquet's success at Bushy Run, nor the relief of Fort Pitt. For there is ever a drop in the cup left, another shot to be fired, another life to be taken off cruelly, in unmediated hate, every day in this forest life, somewhere. The last dead in this have not yet been born. Young Horst will now pass among you with a raccoon hat. The contribution is sixpence. Thanks to audiences like you, this place is proving to be an elves' treasury. But this is horrible, protests Mason. Mr. Ice, how can you use your private tragedy for the mere accumulation of sixpences? How sinful is that, Mr. Ice wishes to know. Were any of you out here then? Not since Westphalia, such evil. Without restitution, what's the point? Here's my opportunity to redeem some of that terrible time, to convert enemy rifle balls to gold. How can any person of sense object to that? Meanwhile, there all of you are, accosting strangers in taverns, spilling forth your sorrows gratis. One day, if it be his will, God will seize and shake you like wayward daughters, and you will thenceforward give nothing away for free. Between Laurel Hill and Cheat, the account book shows at least 111 hands on the pay list, not including the surveyors, various Macleans, and those forever omitted from the official books. Once over Laurel Hill, they are in the country of the old forts. All across these hilltops are the ruins, ancient when the Indians first arrived. Broken walls, fallen nearly to plan views of themselves, act as flues that the wind must find its way past, in a long moan with a rise at the end of it, as if posing a question. The fort at Redstone lies upon the site of one. The creek below is crowded with rocks with lines of glyphs inscribed on them. Nobody can read them, but all believe they are grave markers. The old stories say the forts were built and later abandoned by a nation of giants, who possessed a magic more powerful even than that of the English or the French. Fortification, says Dixon, against what? The Indians laugh. Each other, maybe. Now and then you'll find these gigantic bones, says Hugh Crawford. Human, inquires Mason. Sure seem to be. Been there a long time. Everyone out here knows of the old forts. When it becomes very dark and thunder gusts come sailing in over the ridge line, fanciful uncles tell nieces and nephews that the giant people are back, loud as ever, seeking to reclaim their country. Redeem it. Some bite at this, some do not. Within the broken perimeters lie monoliths that once stood on end. Recumbent, the Indians believe, they are dead or sleeping. Upright they live. Likenesses neither of gods nor of men, but of guardians. Guardians of helpers. They live. They have powers. In England, you see, Mason feels impelled to instruct the Indians, they mark the positions of sun, moon, some say planets, through the year. They are tall, like men, for the same reason our sector is tall, in order to mark more closely these movements in the sky. Small differences mean much to you. There is power in these. The finer the scale we work at, the more power may we dispose. The Lancaster County rifle is precise at long range because of microscopic refinements in the finish, the rifling, the ease with which it may be held and aimed. Those who control the microscopic control the world. Listen to me, defecates with pigeons. Long before any of you came here, we dreamed of you. All the people, even nations far to the south and the west, dreamt you before ever we saw you. We believed that you came from some other world or the sky. You had powers, and we respected them. Yet you never dreamed of us, and when at last you saw us, wished only to destroy us. Then the killing started. Some of you, some of us, but not nearly as many as we'd been expecting. You could not be the giants of long ago who would simply have wiped us away and for less. Instead, you sold us your powers, your rifles, as if encouraging us to shoot at you. And so we did, though not hitting as many of you as you were expecting. Now you begin to believe that we have come from elsewhere, possessing powers you do not. Those of us who knew how have fled into refuge in your dreams at last. Though we now pursue real lives no different at their hearts from yours, we are also your dreams. As they have come west, the visto has grown sensibly wider, and the hands have tended more and more to be in it as little as they may in the daytime as to sleep up and down its center line at night. The axemen begin to depart unannounced, as the army might say, desert. Cheat is the Rubicon, Monongahela is the Styx. At last there are the Indians and 15 axemen newly hired, and Tom Hines, somebody has to cook. And after the first terrible poker invisible up the arse, after allowing themselves a moment to see if they wish to begin screaming and flinging themselves about, Mason and Dixon notice the Indians, politely enough, yet unarguably watching them to see how they will react. Hendricks seems fascinated. What do they believe waits them on the other side of the river that sends them away so fast? They said Shawnees, Delawares, Mingos, someone said a tribe whose name they've never heard. A tribe with no name? He translates quickly for his companions, as if trying to finish before being careened by the gathering sea of mirth. We know that tribe. We are afraid of them too. The tribe with no name. The Indians sit and smoke, continuing to laugh for what, to Europeans, might seem a length of time far out of proportion to the jest. The day passes, the night deepens, the absence of the axemen is felt at eardrums and elbow joints, as in the sleeplessness attending watch and watch, as the days of their westering, even the most obtuse of the company can see, are rapidly decremented, as in a game of darts, to zero, waiting moment upon moment the last fatal double. Chapter 69. One day, yet east of Cheat, a light snow descending but scarce begun to stick, several of the party observe a girl chasing a chicken across the visto when an odd thing happens. Smack at the very center, directly upon the line, the chicken stops, turns about till its head points west and tail east, and thenceforward remains perfectly still, seemingly fallen into a trance. The girl, after guarantees from both surveyors of the chicken's safety, moves on to other chores, whilst the day wheels over and down into dusk, and everyone in the crew comes by to have a look at the immobile fowl for as long as their obligations may allow. It is well known, various ancient Pennsylvanians and Marylanders assure the surveyors, that placing a chicken upon a straight line will send it nodding faster than ever a head put under a wing. The girl, returning to fetch her hen, agrees briskly. Chicken on a line? Thought everybody knew that. Dixon's idea of thrift is offended. Well, that's an attractive nuisance, isn't it? What's to keep them all from wandering in at any moment? Every clucker clear to Ohio and back to Chesapeake. Lining up, going into a daze, presently thronging the visto. We could have a chicken's black hole of Calcutta here. Except that being in America, they'd all have to be removed gently, one by one, wasting days, lest any fowl keeper whose stock has suffered even a feather's molestation call down, among these lawyer-crazed people, a vengeful pursuit after reimbursement upon a biblical scale that may beggar our mission. Mason groans. Shall wise doctors one day write history's assessment of the good resulting from this line, vis-a-vis the not-so-good? I wonder which list will be longer. Hark, hark! You wonder, that's all? One of the enigmata of the invisible world is how a voice unlocalized may yet act powerfully as a moral center. Is the duck speaking, naturally, or rather artificially? What about care? Don't you care? This visto is a result of what we have chosen in our lives to work at. Dixon, bewildered that the topic is even coming up, unlike some mechanical waterfowl, we have to what on our planet is styled work. Running lines is what surveyors do, explains Mason. Thank you, Mason, says Dixon. And one of the few things stargazing's good for is finding out where you are exactly upon the surface of the Earth. Put us two together with enough axemen, you have a sort of visto engine. Two clients wish to have a visto for one of their boundaries. Here we are. What other reason should we be together for? Thank you, Dixon, says Mason. Later that night, and, as he hopes, out of the duck's hearing, Mason says, I've been thinking about that chicken today. I know how lonely it gets out here, though aren't they said to be moody? Only a moment, dear colleague, pray you. Suppose right lines cause narcolepsy in all fowl, including... The duck, Dixon exclaims. Why, aye, as in the Chinaman's refrain, there's all that bad energy flowing there night and day. Bad for us, anyhow. But for the duck, who knows? Mightn't it rather be nourishing her, helping to increase her powers, even uncommonly so? Exactly. 'Twould explain her relentless presence near it. Yes, the trick, should we wish to play it, would be to see her perfect location upon the line, symmetrically bisected. Facing east or west? What matter? She can turn upon a farthing however fast she goes. Pond larvae, offers Armand, feeling like a traitor. She still fancies them. A decoy. We need a painted wood representation of a duck. Tom Hines is the very man, sir. Hand him a pine log, and he'll carve you a quacker you can't tell from real, even close enough to scare it away. It must look like an automatic duck, not a natural one. Tom does a better job on the decoy than he knows. Soon the duck is spending hours, stilled, companionably close to the expressionless object. One day, in an access, she throws herself upon it, going to beak-bite its neck, and of course the truth comes out. Wood. For a moment, it seems she will sigh, ascend, accelerate once more, back into her realm of velocity and spleen. Instead, well, it's a beginning, she says. It floats like a duck. It fools other ducks, who are quite sophisticated in these matters, into believing it a duck. It's a basis. Complexity of character might develop in time. Quiet, good-looking, ever there to drop in on after a long tour of flying, and where there's one withal, why, there's more of the same. Famine to feast. Who needs bright conversation? And that's why, around those foothills, some nights when the wind is blowing backwards and the moon's just gone behind the clouds, you can hear the hum of her going by. Due west, due east, and that forlorn comeback call, and then folks will say, 'Tis the Frenchman's duck, out cruising the line. Why doesn't somebody set her free? The children of settlers up and down the line want to know. Go in, get her, bring her out. Not so easy. Anybody finds a chance to try it, she disappears. She's like a ghost who haunts a house, unable to depart. A ghost usually has unfinished business. What, thank you, detains the duck? A simple, immoderate desire for the orthogonal, in the opinion of Professor Vohm, which cannot allow her even the thought of life away from that much straightness, the leagues of perfect straightness, perfect alignment with Earth's spin, flying back and forth, east and west, forever, the buffeting of the magnetic currents, the ebb and flow of nations over the land surface, the pulse and breath of the solid planet, the dance with the moon, the entire great massive progress round and round the sun. For a while after becoming a resident of the visto, the duck accosts travelers for miles up and down the line, ever seeking Armand. For the chance at revenge, it is worth slowing into visibility, besides giving her an opportunity to chat. Here, producing from some interior recess a sheaf of notices in print, clipped from various newspapers and street bills, here, voila, with the flotteur and the tambourine player. In the center, 'tis moi, moi. Listen to what Voltaire wrote about me to the Count and Countess d'Argental. Without the voices of L'Amour and Vaucanson's duck, we can never recall the glory of France. All right? L'Amour, who's that? Some soprano. Fine, I'm a big-hearted sort of feel. The glory of France certainly knows how to share a stage. You think it was easy every night with those two musicians, listening again and again to that ordure? You'd think now and then a little Bizzozzi at least. Any Bizzozzi would have done. Relief? Forget it. Not in the rooms we worked. Took all my stage discipline not to start quacking along with those grand high C's. One admires the man, genius engineer, but his taste, musically speaking, runs from none to doubtful. The true humiliation came at the end of each exhibition, when Vaucanson actually opened me up and showed to anyone who wished to stare any bon mondaine the intricate web within of wheels, levers, and wires, unto the last tiny piece of linkage, nay, the very falling plummet that gave me life. Nowadays, itself morphosed so as to fall without end. They pointed, tittered, sketched exquisitely in the air. Indignity absolute. He would never allow anyone the least suspicion that I might after all be real. Inside me lay truth mechanical. Outside was but clever impersonation. I was that much his creature that he owned the right to deny my soul. His undoing was in modifying my design, hoping to produce Venus from a machine, as you might say. My submission was not yet complete enough. In the years before the next war, as public tastes veered in quite another direction and we were left becalmed, each in the company of few but the other, his demands grew less and less those of a man of science. He wished, rather, to hear sounds of affection and contentment in his presence. He got nothing more abandoned than wing caresses, perhaps a beak bite, a limited repertoire, but all the same one felt compromised. He wished to control utterly not an automaton, but a creature capable of love,